Instead of being limp, the body was stiff. "Rigor mortis," Pete explained. "The skeletal muscles contract, locking the joints. Onset varies depending on temperature and lesser factors. It starts in as little as 10 minutes and lasts for up to 72 hours.
"You can tell how long she's been dead by how stiff she is."
"Precisely," he confirmed. "By the time I got to our victim yesterday afternoon, she had been dead approximately 3 to 6 hours.
"That's quite a window."
"Science is not as precise as we'd like to believe."
Amanda tried to turn the arm. It wouldn't move.
"Don't worry about being gentle. She can't feel pain anymore."
Amanda heard the sound of her throat working as she swallowed. She wrenched up the arm. There was a loud popping sound that sent a knife into Amanda's chest.
"Breathe in and out," Pete advised. "Remember, it's just tissue and bone."
Amanda swallowed again. The sound echoed in the room. She looked at Lucy Bennett's fingers. "There's something under her fingernails."
"Very good catch."
He went over to the cabinet in the corner.
"We can send it to the lab for analysis."
Amanda wished she had Roz Levy's magnifying glass. It wasn't grime under the girl's fingernails. "What do you think it is?"
"If she fought back, it's probably skin scratched off her attacker. Let's hope she managed to draw blood."
Pete was back with a glass slide and something that looked like an oversized toothpick.
"Hold her steady."
Pete scraped the wooden pick under the fingernail. A long piece of skin came out.
"If there's enough blood in this skin tissue and you find a suspect, we can analyze his blood and see if it's the same type, whether he's a secretor or non-secretor."
"We'll need more than blood to convict him."
"The FBI is doing amazing work with enzymes right now."
He tapped the skin tissue onto the slide.
"In 10 years' time, they'll have samples from everyone in America stored on thousands of different computers all around the country. All you'll have to do is send the sample around to each computer and, bingo, within months, you'll know your perpetrator's name and address."
"You should tell that to Butch and Rick."
The two homicide detectives would probably laugh in his face.
"This is their case."
"Is it, really?"
She didn't bother answering the question. "I guess I don't have to tell you how much trouble Evelyn and I would be in if they found out we were down here poking around."
Pete put the slide on the counter. "You know, the GBI can't find enough women to meet their quotas. They're going to lose their federal grants if they don't fill up the slots by the end of the year."
"I work for the Atlanta Police Department."
"You don't have to."
Pete obviously didn't know Duke Wagner as well as everyone else she'd met today.
Forget Butch and Rick. Her father would have a canary if he knew Amanda was at the morgue. Touching a dead person?
Talking to a hippie about leaving her steady job to be the token woman on the state's police force.
In for a penny, she supposed. There was still the reason they'd come here in the first place.
Amanda turned the woman's hand out, exposing the wrist to the light. There they were, the familiar white scars.
"She tried to kill herself before."
"Maybe," Pete allowed.
"A lot of young women cut themselves. Generally, it's for attention. Your victim was obviously an addict. You can see that from the track marks. If she wanted to kill herself, she would have doubled down with the needle and her old friend H."
Amanda realized. "You washed her."
"Yes, we took photographs and x-rays, then we cut off her clothes and washed her down in preparation for the procedure. She'd urinated on herself, an unfortunate byproduct of strangulation, though one could point out this pales in comparison to the intestinal prolapse." He added, "I should point out that she was remarkably clean considering her occupation and addiction."
"What do you mean?"
"There was the expected results of the fall. Picture a water balloon being dropped from that height. But in my experience, addicts don't favor bathing. The natural oils clog the skin. They think it holds the drug in longer. I'm not sure if there's a scientific basis for that, but someone who injects drain cleaner into their veins isn't necessarily troubled by the facts. You can see the trimming."
He indicated the short pubic hair.
"That's unusual, but I've seen it before," Some men are drawn to women who appear more infantilized. Child molesters? Not necessarily.
Amanda nodded, though her eyes avoided the area Pete was talking about. Instead, she studied Lucy's hands again. The fingernail polish was perfect except for the chip. The strokes were even. It had taken a lot of time and patience to apply such a thick coat. Even Amanda, who buffed and clear-coated her nails in front of the television every night, couldn't manage such an expert job.
Pete asked, "Did you find something else?"
Her fingernails.
"Are they fake? I've been seeing a lot of those plastic ones out of California lately."
"It looks like..." Amanda shook her head. She didn't know what it looked like. The nails were trimmed in a straight line. The cuticles were neat. The red polish was evenly within the margins. She'd never met a woman who could afford a professional manicure. She doubted a dead prostitute would be the first. Amanda walked around the table and looked at Lucy's other hand. Again, the polish was perfect, as if someone else had applied it for her. Amanda opened her mouth to speak, then stopped herself.
"Go on," Pete said. "There are no silly questions in here."
"Can you tell if she's left or right-handed?" Pete beamed at Amanda as if she was his star pupil.
"There will be more muscle attachment to the bone on the dominant side."
"From holding a pen?"
"Among other things. Why are you asking?"
"When I paint my fingernails, one side always looks better than the other. With her, both sides look perfect."
He smiled. "This, my dear, is why more women should be in my field."
Amanda doubted any sane woman would ever do this job. At least, not one who ever wanted to get married. "Maybe she has a friend who painted her fingernails."
"Do women really groom one another? I assumed behind the green door was taking cinematic liberties."
Amanda ignored the observation. She carefully put Lucy's hand back down on the table. It was so easy to focus on the parts rather than the whole. She let herself forget that Lucy Bennett was an actual human being. This was to be blamed in part because Amanda had not yet looked at the girl's face. Amanda forced herself to do so now. She felt her early steeliness, but there was a tandem emotion of what could only be called curiosity. With the blood washed from Lucy's face, she looked different. As in Roz's photo, the skin still hung loosely to the side, but something beyond the obvious was not right.
"Could you?"
Amanda didn't want to sound morbid, but she pushed through it.
"Can I see her teeth?" "Most of them were broken in the fall. What are you getting at?"
"The skin on her face, is it possible to move it back to..."
"Oh, of course."
Pete went to the head of the table. He gripped the loose flesh of the cheek and forehead and pulled it back over her skull. Lucy had bitten her lip in the fall. Pete returned it to the proper position. He used his fingers to tack the skin into place around the eyes and nose, like a baker kneading dough.
"What do you think?"
Amanda realized it was exactly as she had expected. This woman was not Lucy Bennett. The scars on her wrists weren't the only indication. The open sores on her feet had a familiar pattern, like a constellation of stars. Barring that, there was the face, which clearly belonged to Jane Delray.
"I think we need to get Evelyn back in here."
"How intriguing."
Amanda left the room through the swinging doors. The lab was empty, so she pushed open the other set of doors leading into the hallway. Evelyn was several yards ahead, close to the entrance. She was talking with a man wearing a navy blue suit. He was tall, over 6 feet. His sandy brown hair touched his collar. The tailoring of his clothes was obviously professional. The jacket curved into his back. The flared pants hovered over his white loafers. He was finishing a cigarette when Amanda joined them. Evelyn shot her a look, her eyes practically bulging from their sockets. She was talking to Mr. Blue Suit.
"Mr. Bennett."
Evelyn's voice was pitched higher than usual, though she was doing a good job of hiding her excitement.
"This is my partner, Miss Wagner."
He barely glanced at her. keeping his eyes on his white loafers as he stamped out the cigarette.
As I said, I just want to see my sister and leave.
We had a few more questions, she began, but Bennett cut her off.
Is there a man I can talk to, someone in charge?
Amanda thought of Pete. The coroner's in the back. Bennett's lips twisted in distaste. Whether at the thought of the coroner or what he saw in Amanda, she wasn't sure. And it really didn't matter. The only thing she could focus on was how arrogant and unlikable he was. Amanda said,
Dr. Hansen is preparing the body. It'll only be a few more minutes.
Evelyn picked up the lie.
You won't want to see her how she is now, Mr. Bennett.
I don't want to see her, period, he snapped back. As I told you, Mrs. Mitchell, my sister was a drug addict and a whore. What I'm doing here is a mere formality so that my mother can have some peace at the end of her life.
His mother has cancer, Evelyn explained. Amanda let a few seconds pass out of respect for the man's mother, but she couldn't stop herself from asking,
Mr. Bennett, can you tell us when was the last time you saw your sister?
He glanced away. 5, maybe 6 years.
He looked down at his watch. It was a furtive movement, as obvious as Evelyn tugging the back of her hair.
I really do not appreciate your wasting my time. Shall I go back to the coroner?
Just another minute.
Amanda had never been good at spotting a liar, but Bennett was as easy to read as an open book.
Are you sure that's the last contact you had with your sister?
Bennett took a pack of parliaments from his breast pocket and shook out a cigarette. A large gold college ring was on his middle finger. UGA Law School, class of 74, the Georgia Bulldog was etched into the red stone. Amanda asked,
Mr. Bennett, are you sure about the timing? It seems like you've had contact with Lucy more recently.
He showed a flash of guilt as he jammed the cigarette between his lips.
I mailed her a letter to the Union Mission. It was perfunctory, I assure you.
On Ponce de Leon?
Amanda asked. The Ponce Union Mission was the only homeless facility that allowed women.
Bennett said, I tried to find Lucy when our father passed away. My mother had it in mind that she'd joined the hippie movement. You know, just dropped out for a while. She thought Lucy would want to come home, go to college, live a normal life. She could never accept that Lucy chose to be a whore.
Evelyn asked, When did your father pass? Bennett flicked his gold lighter, taking his time to light the cigarette. He didn't speak again until he'd blown out a stream of smoke.
It was a few weeks after I graduated from law school.
Last year?
Yes, July or August, I can't recall.
He inhaled deeply on the cigarette.
Lucy was never really a good girl. I suppose she fooled us all right up until she ran off with some greaser to Atlanta. I'm sure you've heard this story more than a dozen times.
He exhaled, smoke curling from his nostrils.
She was always too willful, stubborn.
Amanda asked,
How did you know to mail the letter to the Union Mission?
Bennett seemed irritated that she wouldn't let him change the subject.
I made some calls to some people. They said that Lucy probably would have ended up there.
Amanda wondered who these people were. She took a chance.
Are you a litigator, Mr. Bennett?
No, I do tax abatement. I'm a first-year associate at Treadwell Price downtown. Why do you ask?
So, Evelyn was right. He'd obviously gotten his boss to make a phone call.
Did you hear back from your sister?
No, but the man working there assured me that he gave the letter to Lucy, for whatever that's worth.
Do you remember the man's name?
Trask, Trent.
Bennett blew out a plume of smoke.
I don't know. He was very unprofessional. Dirty clothes, hair unkempt. Frankly, there was an odor about him. I imagine he's a marijuana smoker.
You met him in person?
You can't trust these people.
He sucked on the cigarette.
I thought I might find Lucy there. What I found was a bunch of disgusting whores and drunkards. Just the sort of place I knew Lucy would end up.
Did you see her?
Of course not. I doubt I would even recognize her.
Amanda nodded, though this seemed like an odd statement coming from a man who was about to identify his dead sister's body. Evelyn asked, "Do you know a young woman named Kitty Treadwell?" He narrowed his eyes. Smoke drifted from the tip of his cigarette.
"What do you know about Kitty?"
He didn't let them answer.
"You two ladies should mind where you stick your noses. They're liable to get cut off."
The front door slammed open. Rick Landry and Butch Bonney walked into the hallway. Both men scowled when they saw Amanda and Evelyn.
"Finally," Bennett mumbled.
Landry was visibly furious. He stomped forward, demanding,
"What the hell are you two slits doing here?"
Amanda was standing beside Evelyn. It didn't take much to get in front of her, blocking Landry in the process.
"We're investigating our case."
Landry didn't bother responding to her statement. He turned, his shoulder bumping into Amanda's so hard that she had to step back.
"Hank Bennett."
Bennett nodded.
"Are you in charge?"
"Yes,"
Landry said. "We are."
He crowded out Amanda, forcing her to step back again as he inserted himself between her and Bennett.
"I'm sorry about your loss, sir."
Bennett waved his hand as if it was nothing.
"I lost my sister a long time ago."
Again, he checked his watch.
"Can we get this over with? I'm late for supper."
Landry walked him down the hallway. Butch took up the rear. He glanced back at Amanda and Evelyn. He gave Amanda an unwelcome wink. She waited until they disappeared behind the door. Evelyn hissed out air between her teeth. She put her hand to her chest. She was shaking.
"Come on."
Amanda grabbed Evelyn's hand. The other woman was resistant. Amanda had to pull her down the hallway. She pushed ajar the door to the lab just as the three men were walking into the morgue. Amanda waited until they were inside before opening the door. She kept her knees bent as if she was sneaking around. The curtains on the large picture window were still drawn. Evelyn whispered,
"Amanda."
"Shh,"
Amanda shot back. Carefully, she parted the drapes a few inches. Evelyn joined her as they peered through the window. Pete Hansen stood with his back to the far wall. His arms were crossed. He'd struck Amanda as a very easygoing fellow, but there was something in his posture that indicated he was very unhappy. Landry and Butch had their backs to the window. Hank Bennett stood opposite, the dead girl between them. He was looking down at the victim's face. Apparently, Evelyn was too. She whispered,
"That's Jane Del Rey."
At the same moment, Hank Bennett said,
"Yes, that's my sister."
11. April 15th, 1975. Lucy Bennett.
There was another girl in the next room. The old one was gone. She hadn't been bad, but this one was awful. Constantly crying, sobbing, begging, pleading. She sure as hell wasn't moving. Lucy could guarantee that none of them moved. The pain was too excruciating, too unspeakable. It took your breath away. It blacked you out. At first, it was impossible not to try. Claustrophobia took over, the unreasonable fear of suffocation. It started in the legs like the cramps from withdrawal. Your toes curled. Your muscles ached to contract. It worked its way through your body like a violent storm. Last month, a tornado had hit the governor's mansion. It started in Perry Homes, but no one cared about that. The governor's mansion was different. It was a symbol, meant to show businessmen and visiting dignitaries that Georgia was the heart of the New South. The tornado had other ideas. The roof had been torn off, the grounds damaged. Governor Busby said that he was saddened by the destruction. Lucy had heard him say so on the news. It was a special bulletin cut between the replay of the Top 40 countdown. Linda Ronstadt's "When Will I Be Loved?" Then the governor saying they were going to rebuild. A phoenix rising from the ashes. Hopeful. Certain. Back when it got really cold, the man had started to let Lucy listen to the transistor radio. He kept it turned down low so the other girls couldn't hear. Or maybe he kept it low, special for Lucy. She would listen to the news, tales of the whole wide world spinning by. She would close her eyes and feel the ground moving underneath her. Lucy didn't like to think too much about it, but she could tell she was his favorite. It reminded her of the game she and Jill Henderson used to play in elementary school. Jill was good with her hands. She'd take a sheet of notebook paper and fold it into triangles. What was it called? Lucy tried to think. It didn't help that the other girl was sobbing so hard. She wasn't loud, but she was consistent, like a kitten mewing. Cootie catchers, that was it. Jill would slide her fingertips into the folded sections. There were words written on the inside. You asked who liked you. Who was going to marry you? Were you going to be happy? Were you going to have one kid or two? Yes, no, maybe. Keith, John, Bobby. It wasn't just the radio that made Lucy feel special. The man spent more time with her. He was gentler with her than he was before, than he was with the other girls, because Lucy could hear it. How many other girls had there been? Two? Three? All weak. All familiar. The new girl in the other room should stop fighting back. She should just give in and he would make it all better. Otherwise, she would end up like the girl before. And the one before that. Nothing would get better. Nothing would change. Things had changed for Lucy. Instead of the pieces of Vienna sausage and stale bread he'd shoved between her teeth in the early days, he was letting her feed herself. She sat on the bed and ate McDonald's hamburgers and French fries. He would sit in the chair, knife in his lap, watching her chew. Was it Lucy's imagination, or was her body healing itself? She was sleeping more deeply now. Those first weeks, months, she'd had nothing to do but sleep. But back then, every time she found herself nodding off, she'd jerk awake and panic. Now, oftentimes when he came into the room, he had to wake her. Gentle nudge of the shoulder, stroke along the cheek. The warm feel of the washcloth, the careful tending of her body. He cleaned her. He prayed over her. He made her whole. Back on Juice's corner, the girls would trade stories about the bad Johns out there. Who to watch out for, who you would never see coming. There was the one who stuck a knife in your face, the one who tried to put his whole fist inside you, the one who wore a diaper, the one who wanted to paint your fingernails. In the scheme of things, was this guy really that bad? 12. Present day. Tuesday. The morning sun was just winking open its eye when Will raked back the passenger seat in Faith's Mini. A body had been found, probably the missing Georgia Tech student, and he was wasting time adjusting knobs on a clown car so that his head wouldn't press against the roof. Faith waited until he was putting on his seatbelt to speak. "You look awful." Will glanced at her. She was wearing her GBI regs, khaki pants, navy blue shirt, and her Glock strapped to her thigh. "Thank you." Faith backed the car down the driveway. The wheels bumped over the curb. She didn't say anything else, which was unusual. Faith tended to chat. She tended to pry. For some reason, she was doing neither this morning. Will should have been worried about this, but there were only so many burdens he could take on at once. His useless night in the basement, his argument with Sarah, the fact that his father was out of prison, whatever Amanda was hiding from him, that there was a dead body at Techwood, that he had kissed his wife. Will put his fingers to his mouth again. He'd wiped off Angie's lipstick with a paper towel, but he could still taste the bitter chemical residue. Faith said, "There's an accident on this side of North Avenue. Do you mind if I take the long way through Ansley?" Will shook his head. "Did you not get any sleep last night?" "Off and on."
You missed a place on your... She touched the side of her cheek. When Will didn't respond, she flipped down the visor in front of him. Will stared at his reflection in the mirror. There was a small strip of beard he'd missed with the razor this morning. He looked at his eyes. They were bloodshot. No wonder people kept telling him he looked bad. "This Techwood murder," Faith began. "Donnelly was the first responder." Will flipped up the visor. Detective Leo Donnelly had been Faith's partner when she worked homicide with the APD. He was slightly annoying, but his greater sin was mediocrity. "Have you talked to him?" "No, just Amanda." She paused, as if to give Will the opportunity to ask what Amanda had said. After a few silent seconds, she told him, "I know about your father." Will stared out the window. Faith had taken more than the long way. There were better routes to bypass North Avenue on the way to Techwood. She had navigated the back roads to Monroe Drive. They were skirting Piedmont Park and heading toward Ansley. It was 6 o'clock in the morning. There was no accident on North. She said, "Mama told me last night. She needed me to make a phone call." Will watched the houses and apartment buildings go by. They passed the vet's office where Betty got her shots. "There's a guy I used to date way back when. I think you met him once. Sam Lawson. He's a reporter for the AJC. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution." Will didn't want to think about the why behind Evelyn Mitchell's request. He assumed Amanda was making some kind of Machiavellian move, trying to get ahead of whatever the paper was going to print. Sarah read the AJC every morning. She was the only person Will knew who still got the paper delivered. Was this how Sarah was going to find out? Will could imagine the phone call. If she called, maybe she wouldn't. Maybe Sarah would see this as an easy opportunity to get out of whatever they had started. Faith said, "That's how Amanda found out about your father's parole." She paused, again anticipating a response. "Sam called her office and asked for a quote. He wanted to know how she felt about him getting out." Faith stopped at the red light. "He's not going to run the story. I fed him some details on a biker gang APD busted for running crank out of a charter school. It's a front-page story. Sam won't circle back." Will stared at the darkened strip of Ansley Mall. The upscale stores weren't open yet. Their lights glowed in the low dawn. He felt a strange sensation, like he was being driven to the hospital for surgery. Some part of his body would be removed. He would have to recover from that. He would have to find a way to acclimate his senses so they did not feel the gaping hole. Faith asked, "What did you do to your hands?" Will tried to bend his fingers. It hurt just flexing them. His ankle throbbed with every beat of his heart. His basement excursion was being felt by every joint in his body. "Anyway," Faith swung through the steep curve that took them up 14th Street, "I looked up his case." Will was more than familiar with his father's crimes. "He dodged a bullet. Furman versus Georgia was in the early 70s. 72, Will provided. The landmark Supreme Court case had temporarily suspended the death penalty. A few more years either side, and Will's father would have been put to death by the state of Georgia. He said, "Gary Gilmore was the first man executed after Furman." "Spree killer, right? Up in Utah?" Faith loved reading about mass murderers. It was an unfortunate hobby that often came in handy. Will asked, "Is it a spree if it's only two people?"
"I think two qualify so long as the timing is close.
I thought that it had to be three."
"I think that's just for serial killers."
Faith took out her iPhone. She typed with her thumb as she waited to make an illegal turn onto Peachtree. Will stared up 14th Street. He couldn't see the hotel from his vantage point, but he knew that the Four Seasons was two blocks away. That was probably why Faith was making the turn. She knew that his father was staying at the hotel. Will wondered if he was still in bed. The man had been in prison for over 30 years. It was probably impossible for him to sleep late. Maybe he'd already ordered his breakfast from room service. Angie said he used the gym every morning. He was probably running on the treadmill, watching one of the morning shows, and planning his day. "Here we go. Two or more qualifies as a spree." Faith dropped her iPhone back into the cup holder and turned against the light. "Can we talk about your father now?" Will said, Did you know that Peachtree Street is Georgia's Continental Divide?
He pointed to the side of the road.
Rain that falls on that side of the road goes to the Atlantic. Rain on this side goes to the Gulf. Maybe I've got the sides mixed up, but you get the gist.
That's fascinating, Will.
I kissed Angie.
Faith nearly ran up on the sidewalk. She jerked the car back into the lane. She was silent for a while before she muttered, "You fucking idiot." That felt more like it.
What are you going to do?
I don't know.
He stared out the window again. They were heading toward the thick of downtown.
I think I have to tell Sarah.
No, you most certainly do not. Are you crazy? She'll kick your ass to the curb.
She probably should. There was no way that Will could explain to Sarah that the oldest cliche in the world happened to be true this one time. The kiss meant nothing.
For Will's part, it had been a reminder that Sarah was the only woman he wanted to be with. Maybe the first woman he'd ever really wanted to be with. For Angie's part, the kiss had been tantamount to a dog raising its leg on a fire hydrant. Faith asked, "Do you want to be with Angie?"
"No."
He shook his head.
"No."
Was there anything else?
Will remembered he'd touched her breast.
Not...
He wasn't going to get into specifics with Faith.
There was no contact between...
Okay, I get it. She turned onto North Avenue.
Jesus, Will.
He waited for her to continue.
You can't tell Sarah.
I can't hide things from her.
She laughed so loud his ears hurt.
Are you kidding me? Does Sarah know about your father? Does she know that he...
No.
Faith did not bother to hide her incredulity.
Well, then don't let this be the one thing you tell her the truth about.
It's different.
Do you think Angie will tell her?
Will shook his head. Angie's moral code wasn't easily decipherable, but Will knew she would never tell Sarah about the kiss. It was much better to use it to torture Will. Faith cut straight to the point.
If it's not going to happen again, and it didn't mean anything, then you're just going to have to live with the guilt. Or live without Sarah.
Will couldn't talk about this anymore. He stared out the window again. They were stopped at a red light. The lights were on at the Varsity. In a few hours, the curb men would be out sweeping the lot, slapping numbers on cars and taking orders. Mrs. Flanagan used to bring the older kids to the Varsity once a month. It was a reward for good behavior.
Faith asked, "Have you ever tried to talk to the detectives who worked your mother's case?"
"One disappeared. Somebody thought he moved to Miami. The other died from AIDS in the early 80s.
"Did either of them have family?"
"No one I could find."
Honestly, Will hadn't looked that hard. It was like picking at a scab. There came a point when you started to draw blood.
"I can't believe how many conversations I've had with you over the last 2 years, and you never told me about this."
Will left her to wonder why on her own. Faith crossed the interstate. The athlete dorms that had been built for the Olympics had the Georgia Tech logo on them now. The old stadium was being remodeled. The streets were freshly paved. Brick inlays carpeted the sidewalks. Even this early in the morning, students were out jogging. Faith turned at the next light. She was more than familiar with the area. Her son was currently enrolled at Georgia Tech. Her mother had gotten her doctorate here. Faith had finished her 4-year degree at the university so she could qualify for employment with the GBI. Faith slid a piece of notebook paper out from her visor. Will saw that she'd scribbled directions on it. She slowed the car, mumbling, "Centennial Park North. Here we go." Finally, she turned onto a side street, downshifting as they went up a hill. The area was filled with upscale brick apartment buildings and townhouses. The cars on the street were nice, newer Toyotas and Fords, with an occasional BMW thrown in. The grass was trimmed, the eaves and windows were painted a crisp white. Satellite dishes dotted every other balcony. The compound was designed to be mixed income, which meant a handful of poor people lived in the less desirable units, and the rest went for top dollar. Will imagined that some of the better-off students lived here, rather than the dorms, where Faith's son resided.
"Zell Miller Center," Faith read from the sign. "Clark Howell Community Building, here we go."
She slowed the car to a crawl.
The directions weren't really needed anymore. Two cruisers blocked the street. Police tape cordoned off a group of residents. Most were in pajamas and robes. A few of the joggers had stopped to find out what was happening. Faith had to drive down several blocks to find a space. She pulled up onto a berm and jerked up the parking brake. She asked Will, "Are you okay?" He was going to ignore the question, but that didn't seem fair. "We'll see," he managed, then got out of the car before she could say anything else. The street lights were still on, supplementing the rising sun. Two newscopters hovered overhead. Their whirring blades chopped the air into white noise. More reporters were camped out down the road. Cameras were set up on tripods. Reporters were checking their makeup, scribbling their notes. Will didn't wait for Faith. He headed back toward the crime scene, where he could see Amanda Wagner was waiting. Her arm was in a sling, the only indication that she'd spent the night in the hospital. She stood on the sidewalk, dressed in her usual monochromatic skirt, blouse, and jacket. Two burly patrolmen were looking down at her, nodding as she gave them orders. They looked like football players huddled before a snap. As Will and Faith approached Amanda, the patrolmen jogged off toward the bystanders, probably to get names and photos so they could run them through the database. Amanda was old school with all her investigations. She didn't rely on a blood sample or a stray hair to sway a jury. She worked the case until she got a resolution that no logical human being could ever doubt. She also didn't bother with small talk.
"I don't want you here."
"Then why did you call me?"
"Because I knew you wouldn't stay away."
Amanda didn't wait for a response. She turned on her heel, heading toward the community building. Will easily matched her brisk pace. Uncharacteristically, Faith kept her distance, trailing several feet behind. Amanda said,
"We're covered up in red tape. As you know, this whole area used to be a slum. The state emptied it out for the Olympics. The city got its finger in the pie. Tech got a piece of it. The Parks Department had its say. The Housing Authority, the Historical Register, which is a joke if there ever was one. We've got more jurisdictions than news vans. APD is supplementing for now, but it's our techs and our ME handling the evidence."
"I want to sit in on the autopsy."
"It'll be hours before..." "I'll wait." "Do you really think that's a good idea?"
Will thought it was a terrible idea, but that wasn't going to stop him.
"You need to bring him in for questioning." "Why would I do that?"
The fact that her voice sounded so reasonable made Will want to punch her.
"You read my father's file."
She stopped, looking up at him.
"Yes. You think it's a coincidence that he got out of prison and a dead student was found dumped at Techwood?" "Coincidences happen all the time."
Her usual certainty was showing some cracks.
"I can't bring him in without probable cause, Will. Due process. The Fourth Amendment. Any of these inalienable rights ringing a bell?"
"That's never stopped you before."
"I found it's within the purview of rich white men to avoid such unpleasantries."
Will realized that she'd backed him into a corner.
"Still, there's nothing more to say." Amanda continued walking. "We have a tentative ID on Ashley Snyder. They found her purse in the dumpster. Her credit cards were there, but her license was missing. So was her cash."
"That sounds familiar."
"Bless the sunshine laws."
Georgia's Freedom of Information Act was one of the most liberal in the country. Inmates were especially fond of the law. Will said,
"He's staying at the Four Seasons Hotel."
"I'm aware of that," she acknowledged. "We lost track of him for 2 hours yesterday afternoon, but I've made certain that won't happen again."
"He's been out almost 2 months."
Amanda didn't immediately answer.
"I've never understood time off for good behavior. It's prison. Shouldn't you be on your best behavior at all times?"
"No one told me when he got out."
"That's the thing about having a sealed juvenile record, Will. They aren't allowed to notify you unless you ask them to."
"He was supposed to die in there."
"I know."
One of the patrolmen called out,
"Dr. Wagner." Amanda said, "You two go on."
She waited for the cop to join her. Will kept walking. Faith had to jog to keep up. She asked, "What was that about?"
He could only shake his head as they entered the mouth of the parking lot. The ground sloped downward. In the back of the lot, a group of detectives formed a half-circle around the body. The woman was in front of a large dumpster area. Brick walls horseshoed the metal container. The tall metal door stood open. The lock was hanging off the latch, the ring broken. Someone had already marked it with a yellow tag so it could be cataloged as evidence. Will glanced around, feeling watched. Or maybe he was just being paranoid. He scanned the area. The community center was on the opposite side of the parking lot. More apartments edged the perimeter. Their white garage doors were like teeth against the gum of the red brick. There was a playground in the distance with brightly colored tunnels and swings. The Coca-Cola building loomed on the horizon. If he squinted at the view back across the interstate, he could pick out the familiar salmon-colored facade of the Four Seasons Hotel.
"Another case solved by the glorious GBI," Leo Donnelly laughed around the cigarette in his mouth.
As usual, the homicide detective was dressed in a tan suit that was probably already wrinkled when he picked it up off the floor this morning. His new partner, a young guy named Jamal Hodge, nodded at Faith. Leo winked at her.
"Looking good across the chest, Mitchell. I guess you're still nursing."
"Fuck off, Leo." Faith took her notebook out of her purse. "When'd the call come in?" Leo pulled out his own notebook.
4:38 in the cheery a.m. Janitor comes on shift, sees her, and freaks. His name's Ote Keyhole."
"Ute Keo," Jamal corrected.
"Look at Poindexter here."
Leo shot him a nasty look.
"Ute is a student at Tech. 24 years old. Lives with his baby mama. No priors."
Faith asked, "How's he look for this?" Jamal supplied, "Not likely." Leo made a show of closing his notebook. He took a drag on a cigarette, staring at Jamal.
"Janitor's 2 years out of Cambodia. Works off his student visa. Voluntarily submitted to fingerprinting and DNA. No record, no motive. I'm sure he's popped a few whores in his day. Who hasn't? But he doesn't even have a car. Took the bus here."
Will asked, "You ID'd the victim off her credit cards?" Jamal held out his hands, indicating Leo should answer.
"We're pretty sure it's Snyder," Leo said. "Face is a mess, but the blonde hair is a giveaway."
Will asked, "Have you notified the family?"
"Mom's dead. Daddy's flying back from a business trip in Salt Lake. Should be here this afternoon."
Jamal added,
"We asked for dental records."
"Great, thanks," Faith mumbled. She was probably thinking about the father's long flight home, the moment at the morgue when his life would forever be changed. They all turned back to the dumpster. The crowd had dispersed so the crime scene techs could begin the arduous process of cataloging the scene. Will looked down at the woman's twisted body, long blonde hair draped across her face. She was on her back. Her arms were turned, wrists open to the sky. Her face was a bloody pulp, probably unrecognizable to even her closest friends. Her fingernails were painted bright red. Blood glued her clothes to her skin. Will could guess what was underneath the tight t-shirt and flowered skirt.
Leo said, "Here's something you don't see every day. Guy pummeled her gut until her intestines shit out. You can't find that kind of thing on YouTube."
He chuckled to himself.
"At least, not until I figure out how to work the camera on my phone."
"Lord help us," Jamal muttered.
He headed toward Charlie Reed, the GBI crime scene investigator.
"Come on, Hodge," Leo called to his back. "It's funny."
Faith said, "Smart, Leo.
You really want to piss off the deputy chief's grandson?"
Will glanced at Faith. Her voice sounded a little shaky. She had never been good around bodies, but through sheer determination, she held her own. One crack in her shell, and Leo, or someone like him, would turn Faith into a joke every squadron was laughing about by morning roll call. Faith had once told Will that working with Leo was like watching a wind-up monkey that couldn't quite get the symbols to meet. Will knew better than to ask if she was okay. Instead, he knelt beside the body.
keeping his distance so he wouldn't taint the area. The crime scene photographers weren't waiting for the sun. Their digital cameras and computers were laid out on a folding table. One of the women turned on the diesel generator. The xenon lights flickered. The victim's hand showed stark against the asphalt. Her red manicured nails glistened as if they were still wet. Faith asked Leo, "What's this building? Is it still a community center?"
"Dunno," Leo shrugged. "Guess they named it after that guy on the radio."
Will stood up too quickly. He fought a wave of dizziness. Clark Howell was the publisher of the Atlanta Constitution.
"No shit," Leo asked.
"He's chock full of fascinating trivia today," Faith said. "Do you have any leads?"
"What's it to you?"
Faith put her hands on her hips.
"Don't be an asshole, Leo. You know this is a state case. Do you have any leads, or should I ask Jamal?"
Leo reluctantly offered.
"I made some calls, checked with downtown. There's nobody on our books what would knock the shit out of a girl like this."
He laughed at his own joke.
"Literally."
"She have any enemies?"
"Y'all should know more about that than me."
"What about a drug problem?"
Leo sniffed, rubbing his nose. "Nothing serious, from what I've heard."
"Coke or meth?"
"She's a student, what do you think?"
"Meth," Faith said. "And watch the generalities, Leo. My kid goes to tech. He doesn't hit anything harder than Red Bull."
"Sure." "Faith,"
Amanda called. She was at the edge of the parking lot, waving them over. Faith shot Leo a nasty look as they headed toward Amanda. Leo yelled at their backs.
"No, don't thank me, officers. It was my pleasure."
Amanda was digging around in her purse when they joined her. She pulled out her BlackBerry. The case was still cracked from her fall. She scrolled through her emails while she talked.
"Patrol found a jogger who saw a suspicious green minivan circling the area shortly after 4 this morning."
"He just came forward?" Faith looked at her watch. "Was he jogging for 2 hours?
"That sounds like a good question to start with. He lives there, apartment 2620.
Amanda indicated the building across the street.
"Make sure you get him on paper. All the T's crossed and the I's dotted."
Will said, "I'll talk to him." He made to go, but Amanda stopped him.
"Faith, you do this."
Faith gave him a look of apology before heading toward the apartment building. Amanda held up a finger, silencing Will. She read a few more emails before dropping her BlackBerry into her purse.
"You know you can't work this case."
"I don't see how you're going to stop me."
"This has to look good on paper. We can't have it falling apart in court."
It held up in court the last time and he still got out.
"Welcome to the criminal justice system. I rather thought you were familiar with it by now."
Will stared across the interstate. Rush hour was gearing up. Cars were starting to clog the 14 lanes. He saw a sign for one of the Emory hospitals. Sarah had gone to Emory University. Grady was part of their teaching system. She would be getting ready for work right now, showering, drying her hair. Will usually walked the dogs before he left. He wondered if she missed that. Amanda said,
"Give me time to do this right, Will. It has to be done right."
Will shook his head. He didn't care about the means, just the end. "We need to work his case from the beginning."
"What do you think I've been doing?" she asked. "I've had 2 teams on this since I found out. We're dealing with a 30-plus-year time gap in a city that tears itself down every 5 years. His old stomping ground is currently a 12-story office complex."
"I'll check it. Faith can go with me."
"It's already been checked top to bottom."
"Not by me." She wasn't looking at him. Like Will, she was staring over the interstate.
"Motive, means, and opportunity."
It was Amanda's mantra. Will said, "You know he's got all 3. She gave a tight nod of her head. If Will hadn't been watching, he would have missed it. He studied her profile. She seemed to be as tired as he was. There were dark circles under her eyes. Her makeup was caked into the creases around her eyes and mouth. She said,
"I have to say, I love what you did with the basement."
Will's hands clenched. The cuts opened up along his fingers.
"Did you find what you were looking for?"
His jaw popped when he opened his mouth to speak. Why were you there?
That's a very interesting question.
How long have you known about my father?
You work for me, Will. It's my job to know everything about you.
Why did that reporter call you?
It makes for a good story, I suppose. Your chosen path of law and order. Your rise from the ashes. Atlanta's symbol is the phoenix. What a fitting dovetail.
He turned and headed toward North Avenue, the bridge over the interstate. Amanda's stride was half as long as Will's. She had to work to match his pace. She asked,
"Where are you going?"
"To talk to my father."
"To what end?"
"You've read his file. You know he has a pattern. He kills one, he keeps one. He's probably already picked her out."
"Shall I put out an APB on a missing prostitute?"
She was mocking him. "You know he's looking for another girl."
"I told you we've got eyes on him. He hasn't left his room."
"Except for yesterday afternoon." She stopped trying to keep up.
"You will not talk to him."
Will turned around. Amanda never raised her voice. She didn't scream. She didn't stamp her foot. She never cursed. She managed to scare everyone by reputation. For the first time in 15 years, he saw through her. She was nothing, really. An old woman with her arm in a sling and secrets she would carry to her grave. She said,
"I've issued a standing order to have you arrested the minute you step one foot in that hotel. Understood?"
He stared his hate into her.
"I should have left you to rot in that basement."
"Oh, Will."
Her voice was filled with regret.
"I have a feeling that by the end of this, we're both going to wish you had."
13. Present day. Susanna Ford. She missed Dancing with the Stars. She missed Bobo, her little dog who died when she was 10. She missed her grandmother, who'd died when Susanna was 11, and her grandfather, who'd died a few months later. She missed Adam, the goldfish, who'd died the night they brought him home from the store. Susanna had found him in the tank just floating on his side. His eye was blank. She could see her reflection in it. Susanna called the store to complain.
"Just flush him down the toilet," the manager said. "Come by tomorrow and we'll give you a new one."
Susanna had felt uneasy at the prospect. It felt wrong. Did Adam mean nothing? Was he that replaceable? Just plop another fish in the tank and forget he even existed? Call that one Adam 2. Feed him Adam's food. Let him swim through Adam's secret treasure box and pink coral castle. In the end, there was nothing else to do. Susanna flushed him down the toilet. As the water circled around the bowl, she saw his fin flip up. The glass orb of his eyeball turned to her. And she had seen something like panic. In her dreams, Susanna was the fish. She was Adam 1, because, of course, the temptation was too great. They had gone back the next day and gotten a free Adam 2. That was the entirety of the dream. Susanna 1, helpless, staring up at the ceiling as she spun, 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 quickly down the drain. 14. July 14, 1975. Monday. Amanda leaned against her Plymouth as she waited for Evelyn in the parking garage of the Sears building. The air did not move in the underground facility. The coolness afforded from the poured concrete walls was no match for the scorching heat. Even at 7 in the morning, Amanda could feel sweat dripping down her neck and into her collar. Neither she nor Evelyn had been up for the barbecue after leaving the morgue on Saturday evening. Hank Bennett. The misidentified girl, the red fingernails, the broken hyoid bone. It was a lot to process, and neither of them seemed up to having a coherent conversation. They'd both talked in monosyllables. Amanda, because of the things she'd seen with Pete Hansen, and Evelyn, most probably because she'd been unsettled about seeing Rick Landry again. No matter their reasons, Evelyn had gone home to her husband, and Amanda had gone home to her empty apartment.
If Sunday brought anything, it was a welcome sense of normalcy. Amanda had cooked breakfast for her father. They'd gone to church. She'd cooked Sunday dinner. All the while, Duke had been notably more cheerful. He'd made a few jokes about the preacher. He was feeling bullish on his case. He'd spoken with his lawyer again. Lars Oglethorpe's reinstatement was definitely good news for the men Reginald Eves had fired. Amanda doubted it was good news for her. Evelyn's station wagon made a tight turn, the tires squealing against the concrete. She backed into the space beside the Plymouth, calling through the open window. "Did Kenny call you yesterday?" Amanda felt a shock of panic.
"Why would Kenny call me?"
"I gave him your number." For a few seconds, Amanda was too flustered to do anything but stare.
"Why would you give him my phone number?"
"Because he asked for it, silly. Why do you sound so surprised, and why are you just standing there?" Amanda shook her head as she got into the car. Men like Kenny Mitchell didn't ask for her phone number.
"That's very nice of you to put him up to this, but let's not waste time on something that's not going to happen."
"You can..." Evelyn stopped, but only for a moment before she blurted out. "You can wear Tampax, right?" Amanda pressed her fingers into her eyelids, not caring whether or not she smudged her makeup.
"If I say yes, can we please change the subject?"
Evelyn wouldn't be daunted. "You know, Pete's a real doctor. He can write you a prescription, no questions asked. And if you slip the guy at the Plaza Pharmacy a few extra bucks, he won't be a jerk about it." Amanda fanned her face. The heat was even more stifling inside the car. She tried not to think about her telephone ringing in her empty apartment yesterday. "It's legal now, sweetheart. You don't have to be married to get birth control anymore." Amanda's laugh was genuine this time.
"I think you're jumping to a lot of conclusions."
"Maybe, but it's fun, isn't it?" It was humiliating, actually, but Amanda tried to hide that fact by looking at her watch again.
"Did this consume your entire Sunday, or did you manage to think at all about what we've been doing?"
Evelyn rolled her eyes. "Are you kidding? It's all that's been on my mind for the last week. I was so distracted this morning, I put salt instead of sugar in Bill's coffee. Poor man drank half the cup before he realized what I'd done." She paused for a breath. "What about you?"
"I've been going over Butch's notes."
Amanda pulled the homicide detective's notebook out of her purse. "See this here?" She pointed to the page for Evelyn's benefit. The letters CI were circled twice. "Confidential informant," Evelyn said. She flipped back through the notebook. "Does he say anything else about it? A name, maybe?"
"Nothing. But a lot of Butch's cases rely on CIs."
"Most of them did, actually. The man was very good at finding criminals and lowlifes who were willing to parlay information into a get-out-of-jail-free card. He never names his sources."
"Oh, that's sneaky."
She scanned the pages, stopping on a crude drawing of the apartment where Jane Delray had lived. "He left out the bathroom." "Did he even search the place?" She answered her own question. "Of course he didn't. Why would he?" Amanda checked the time again. She didn't want to be late for roll call.
"We should go over what we're doing today. I can call my friend at the housing authority when I get to work. Maybe we can find out who rented that apartment."
Evelyn paused for a moment as she switched gears. "I'll call Cindy Murray at the 5 and see if she has time to check the confiscated license box for a Lucy Bennett. At least we'll have a photograph of her."
"I don't know what good it'll do. Pete will have to sign off on the ID. It came from her own brother."
Neither she nor Evelyn had the nerve to contradict Hank Bennett's identification of his sister.
"Bennett hasn't laid eyes on her in 5 or 6 years. Do you think he knew it wasn't Lucy?"
"I think all he cared about was not being late for his dinner date." They were both silent. Amanda felt a ping-pong sensation inside her head. Thoughts kept bouncing around, getting lost. It was just too much to keep up with. Evelyn was obviously feeling the same. She said, "Bill and I started a puzzle last night, Bridges of the Pacific Northwest. Zeke picked it out for Father's Day last month, and I thought, this is exactly how I felt all week. Like, there are all of these different little pieces to a puzzle floating around out there. And if I could only put them together, maybe I'd be able to see the full picture."
"I know what you mean.
All I do is ask myself questions, and I can't seem to get a satisfactory answer to any of them.
Hey, I've got a crazy idea.
You cannot imagine my surprise.
Evelyn gave her a sarcastic grimace, then leaned into the back seat of the station wagon.
What are you doing?
She snaked her body around into the back seat. Her legs went up. Amanda swatted the woman's feet out of her face. She scanned the parking lot, praying they were not being watched.
Evelyn, she said, what on earth?
Got it. Finally, she shimmied back into her seat. She had a pack of construction paper in her hands. Zeke's crayons melted into the carpet. Bring your pen. She pushed open the door. Amanda got out of the car and followed her around to the front of the wagon. Evelyn took a piece of paper off the top of the pack and, using Amanda's pen, wrote Hank Bennett on the page. Next, she took another page and wrote Lucy Bennett. Then on another put Jane Del Rey. She added Mary and Kitty Treadwell into the mix. Then Hodge, Juice / Dwayne Matheson, and finally Andrew Treadwell.
What are you doing? Amanda asked.
Puzzle pieces. She spread the multicolored pages out on the Falcon's hood. Let's put it together. Amanda took in the disparate words. The idea wasn't so crazy after all.
We should do it chronologically.
She moved the names around as she spoke.
Hank Bennett came into the station, and then Sergeant Hodge sent us to Techwood. Make a new one for Tech.
Evelyn scribbled the word onto a new sheet.
We need to subcategorize these.
Amanda took the pen and started filling in details. Dates, times, what they'd been told. The Fury's engine clicked in the heat. The metal hood singed her skin. Evelyn suggested, I'll make a timeline. Amanda handed her the pen. She pointed to the different pages as she called out the sequence.
Hank Bennett goes to Sergeant Hodge last Monday. Hodge immediately sends us out to Techwood to take a rape report.
She looked at Evelyn.
Hodge won't tell us why he sent us in the first place. Obviously, there wasn't a rape. Why did he send us there?
I'll ask him again this morning, but he wouldn't tell me the last four times. Amanda felt the need to tell her,
You were very brave to do that.
Fat lot of good it did. Evelyn waved away the compliment. Juice, the pimp, doesn't belong in here.
Unless he's the one who killed Jane.
That doesn't seem likely. Juice was probably in jail when it happened, or having the crap beat out of him for resisting arrest.
Okay, let's push him up here as a remote possibility.
Amanda moved Juice to the periphery.
Next, we're at the apartment in Techwood. Jane tells us that there are three girls missing. Lucy Bennett, Kitty, who we later find out is Treadwell, and a girl named Mary, last name unknown.
Right. Evelyn wrote down the information, shooting their names off Jane Delray's.
Then, a few days later, Jane is murdered.
But she was misidentified as Lucy, Evelyn corrected. I'll put an asterisk beside her name, but we should keep it this way just for clarity's sake.
Right. A person who is thought to be Lucy Bennett is murdered.
I wonder if the brother had a big life insurance policy on her. Amanda supposed being married to an insurance man put these ideas into Evelyn's head.
Is there a way to check? A registry?
I'll ask Bill, but just talking it out, I think given Lucy's life, why murder her when she would eventually kill herself with drugs? Evelyn looked down at the timeline. It's not much of a motive.
Motive.
There was something they hadn't considered.
Why would someone want to murder Jane?
Are we assuming the killer knew it was Jane whom he was murdering? Amanda's head was starting to hurt.
I think we have to assume that until we find out otherwise.
Okay, motive. Jane was very annoying.
True, Amanda agreed. But the last person she annoyed, other than us, was Juice. And if there's one thing I know about pimps, it's that they don't kill their girls. They want them working, their product.
I'll call the jail and see when Juice got out, just to make triple sure.
Evelyn tapped the pen against her chin.
Maybe the murderer was someone who saw Jane talking to us at Techwood. The whole compound lit up when we arrived. There's no way it wasn't broadcast to the rooftops that Jane was talking to two police officers.
Amanda felt unsettled by the thought that she might have been partly responsible for the girl's death.
Write that down as a possibility.
I hate to think we had anything to do with it. Then again, she wasn't exactly baking cookies for the PTA.
No,
Amanda agreed, but Evelyn had only seen the pictures.
Have you ever had a manicure?
Evelyn looked at her fingernails, which were clear-coated, just like Amanda's. Bill treated me to one last Christmas. I can't say that I enjoyed having a stranger touch my hands.
Jane's fingernails were perfect. They were filed and polished. I couldn't have done a better job myself.
That manicure was ridiculously expensive. I can't imagine Jane having the money.
No, and if she did, she'd spend it on drugs, not getting her fingernails